Hello, Marvelites. You're listening to Marvel's Pull List for new Marvel comics on sale April 27, 2022. I'm Ryan Panagos, aka Agent M.
And I'm Jasmine Estrada.
Yeah. Things are exciting. We're going to be talking about some fun books this week. Mm-hmm. We just, before we were started recording here, we recorded our reading club for episode number 200, which is...
Yeah, I'm pretty surprised at us for being able to record for 200 minutes straight. That was some dedication right there.
Like, I'm doing this thing on Peloton now called Power Zone, and it's all about endurance training. So I've been building up to this. It all works out.
Specifically for episode 200.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we're not here to talk about my training. No, we are here to talk about lots of comics because this is the official Marvel podcast of Marvel Comics. We're going to talk about our picks this week, our favorites, personal favorites for all the books out this week. We're going to tell you what other new comics are out, give out some awards, give out some fun stuff there, talk about the Infinity comics that are on Marvel Unlimited, what else has hit Marvel Unlimited, the collections, and then get into our reading club, which is what, Jasmine?
We are talking to Tochi Anyabuchi for part two of our reading club on Executioner's Song.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Exciting
the
stuff.
Conversation, so big, so important, so momentous that we had to stretch it over two episodes.
It's pretty funny because this one we weren't planning on recording for 200 minutes straight, but ended up doing so anyway.
Yeah. Speaking of the reading club that we're doing with Tochi about Executioner's Song, obviously this week is part two. Last week was part one. We got tons of great excitement about that episode and rereading the story. Our pal Mountain Meg at Meg Stocker tweeted, "I'm starting a reread of Executioner's Song now, thanks to Jasmine and Ryan's latest interview on Marvel's Pull List. Can't wait to hear part two next week. The storyline was right when I was getting into my love for comic books, and it quickly made X-Men my very favorite team. Such great memories. Thanks for the bonus shout-out this week, too. The kids were literally bouncing off the walls when they heard their names last week. More fun kid photos to come, too, we promise. Give us all the photos. I want the kids bouncing all around the world. All the walls.
Yes, all the walls. I also want to point out another tweet that we got from Kareem Ahmed at that Kareem Ahmed on Twitter. He says, "Dang, thanks Agent M, Jasmineist, and Tochi True Story," which is Tochi's Twitter handle if you guys are looking for him on Twitter, "for the dope Executioner's Song reading club. Totally motivated me to go back and reread for the first time since it came out. So epic. Pouches and shoulders for days. Can't believe it took me 30 years to revisit and feeling very old now."
Yeah, this should be an annual tradition for everyone out there. Pick a day that is your Executioner Song day. Read the entire thing in one sitting. Worth every second. We're going to get you into that real soon. So let's dive into the new books on sale this week with our picks. First up is Amazing Spider-Man number one. Jasmine, this issue marks the return of John Romita Jr. to the pages of Amazing Spider-Man regularly. And boy, oh boy, I love Johnny Jr. so much. You got to do some stuff with him for some podcast work, right?
I got to talk to him for the history of Marvel Comics, Black Panther. There's a great, 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 great bonus episode of that podcast over on Apple Podcasts that if you haven't gotten a chance to listen to, I highly recommend it because in it, not only do we get to talk to John Romita Jr. about his work on Black Panther with Reginald Hudlin, but also we got some really intimate moments where he remembers, you know, his father doing work on Daredevil and a bunch of other books and how a lot of that helped form, you know, how he does what he does today, which is very insightful and just amazing.
Yeah. If we were to put together a list of potential greatest Marvel Comics artists of all time, there is no doubt in my mind you would put John Romita Jr. on that list. And it is tremendous. He's the artist here. It is written by Zeb Wells, inks by Scott Hanna, who is also a great partner of Johnny's. Just so good. And colors by Marcio Meniz, with letters by VC's Joe Caramagna. This is also an intense storyline. It's not as like humorous as you expect a Zeb Wells book to be because Zeb does comedy so well, but it also reminds you that Zeb does drama and emotion and devastating beats so incredibly well as well. We saw that in Beyond, but we've seen it. He's done some Doc Ock stuff and some other, you know, things over the years. Here, we're at a place with Peter Parker where things are not all right. And I like that we open in this issue with like something going terribly wrong with Spidey, and then 6 months later, which is a rad way to tell a story. It gives us a lot to wonder about, a lot of mystery. There's a lot of scenes where Spidey or Peter is dealing with the repercussions of whatever he did, which we don't know. And I like that. I want that to be sort of teased out for a while. On top of that, it's full of like great Spidey supporting cast members. You've got Mary Jane in here in a way. I was just like, what the hell?
Oh my God. I got like mad at the book, but in a good way, not in a way where I was like, I'm done reading this book. It was very like, don't do this to me, Zeb. Don't do this to me.
Yeah. We've got that. The conversation he has with Aunt May, to me, it reminded me of the storyline where Aunt May found out his identity as Spider-Man back in the, you know, 15, 20 years ago in the pages of Amazing Spider-Man with John Romita Jr. and J. Michael Straczynski. There are a little, you got Robbie Robertson in here. And then on the villain side, we get Tombstone, we get White Rabbit, which was a lot of fun to see her.
So happy. Yeah. I love how she's the muscle in this book. Tombstone's like, check this out. I got White Rabbit. And the Rose, who's the other antagonist in this book, is like, yeah, me too. Here's Digger, who is like a gamma radiated monster. And White Rabbit's like, I got this.
Yeah. Anyway, there's a lot going on in here. Got to give super duper shout outs, though, to Johnny and Scott and Marcio for Rain. It's one of my favorite things that I've to watch John Romita Jr. draw, and then to have his collaborators work with him on, is drawing characters and things happening in the rain. The way he draws rain and it's splashing, that it feels wet. It's one of those weird things where you read it and you can feel that these characters are covered in water if they don't have an umbrella. You know, like, it's one of those weird things, but it's done so well.
It's done really well. You see the movement in the rain. You see, it's not just like an overlay. It's very, like, as much a part of the scene as the rest of the book and the art is.
So, terrific beginning to a new era for Amazing Spider-Man.
Yeah, super excited about that book. Next up, my first pick of the week is Knights of X, number one. Another number one here. And it's written by Teenie Howard, with art by Bob Quinn, colors by Eric Arciniega, and letters by VC's Ariana Mayer. This book rules. I was very excited that we were going to get a new book from Teenie Howard. We ended Excalibur. It's been like 2 months now since the last issue of Excalibur came out.
Oh, man.
And yeah, it's crazy. And this picks up right where it left off. We have Captain Britain, a.k.a. Betsy Braddock, over in Otherworld by herself without her team, but she is in the midst of a war and she still needs backup. How she gets that backup from mutants on Krakoa is another story, and that's pretty much what happens in this issue. We not only figure out how she does it, but we also see her recruit certain members and why these specific members were chosen. Some of them are returning characters from Excalibur, but we do have a couple of new characters in the midst as well. Which is really exciting. But I do want to quickly highlight the appearance of one Jersey Devil in this book, who I know longtime co-host of the show, Tucker Marcus, is probably really excited about because he is from New Jersey and he is representing hard in this issue. There's moments where we get Shogo, who, if you remember from Excalibur, would transform into a full-sized dragon when in Otherworld. We get to see Shogo's thoughts this time around as a dragon, but they're pretty much just like drawings, like little kid drawings that manifest in like around him in his, when we're talking about his thoughts, which I think is adorable. It just adds another layer to the, like, essentially the way that this story is being told. And then I just really want to also talk about Rachel Summers's new look, because holy shit, is it awesome. It's a new, brand new look that we haven't really seen before in the past, but very much fits into the style of, you know, Otherworld and Excalibur. It's not quite what you would expect, and I've never really been a fan of her costumes before, but this one is probably my all-time favorite, like right off the bat. Like, I love it.
It was a blast. Super fun. All right, let's roll on to Thor number 24, which is legacy numbering Thor number 750. This is a big one, so big that we're going to have to do this together. I know this is one you in particular wanted to talk about, a bunch of the stories in here, because there's a lot going on in this issue. And I'm going to say, first off, the cover of this book tells you a lot about what's going on. It's like giant spoilers. You can't escape it. So I know we tried not to spoil things, but like Odin is dead. Okay. Yeah. And so this issue is about the funeral for Odin and eulogies for Odin. So sorry, but it's like very front and center in this
issue. Also, like not the first time Odin has died, probably.
The death still hits hard, which I think is an important thing to remember because these characters still connect. The core story here, as we've had for previous issues, and which is the framing sequence of this, is written by Donny Cates with art by Nick Klein, colors by Matt Wilson, and letters by VC's Joe Sabino. There is a double page spread, the second or third page of this issue, which features a like wide shot of Asgard in the funeral procession as Odin is laid in this golden casket and pulled by, you know, this his incredible horse, and you see, you know, members of all the different realms and celestials in the background, and it's raining and people are crying, and it's so beautifully, wonderfully depicted by Nick Klein. I like stared at this for a while.
There's so many pieces to it too, and so many different characters of different scale that like really just makes this thing sing.
Yeah. Then we get into sort of Thor reading from this book and telling stories about Odin, which gives us the intro into how we get so many other amazing creators on this book. It's basically telling stories of Odin throughout his life or other things that tied to Odin's legacy and life. So you want to take this next one?
Yeah, it's called Prologue. It's written by Walt Simonson with art done by Walt Simonson and colors by Laura Martin and Matt Mila with letters by John Workman. And I mean, plain and simply, like this is a Beta Ray Bill's prequel. So if you are familiar with Walt Simonson's run, you know that it starts off with Beta Ray Bill just kind of coming in and kicking butt. This is pretty much the stuff that leads up to that point. We learn how Beta Ray Bill got his powers, why he looks like a mutated horse alien. But there is like a little small nugget of like added information here. And it's very much about the program that Beta Ray Bill went through to become who he is today, which is pretty much a super soldier program of sorts, but on a planet full of Corbinites. There is something that's really interesting in here. There's like almost like a character reveal here where it seems like it haunts Beta Ray Bill a little bit. So I'm excited to see if that pops up in the future.
Yeah. The next story is one that is pretty neat because, you know, we talk a lot about Walt Simonson or, you know, some of the other creators in here, Jason Aaron and many others. But one of the a long tenure on Thor was writer Dan Jurgens, who had like a 6-year tenure, maybe a little bit more. He did a great Thor run in the 90s and early 2000s. And this issue has a story written by Dan Jurgens, who also pencils it, inked by Klaus Janson, colored by Matt Wilson, and lettered by VC's Joe Sabino, that is situated like right around the time of Thor number 25. It's got Thor with his gnarly armor and shield and his hammer, and it gets him, he's fighting the Magog, and Thanos was referenced. And you know, in the original run, John Romita Jr. Was the penciler on Thor 25 that connects like directly to this issue. So it's a really neat throwback to another very classic run of Thor comics.
I love the colors on that story as well.
Matt Wilson is one of the greatest of all time.
Hell yeah. Speaking of one of the greatest of all time, the next story in this issue is called Benedictions by J. Michael Straczynski, and it features Olivier Coypel art, which is just gorgeous. When you flip the pages and you get to that story, it's so refreshing to see him back on Thor again. It's probably one of my favorite things that he's done. And just seeing that art again just shines. There's a lot of stuff here again that gets revealed from that same JMS run from a few years ago. And it's nice to enter that world again, come back to some of our favorite eras of Thor, including the next one.
It's a Loki story, and it's been almost 7 years since the end of Loki, Agent of Asgard, which just doesn't seem possible. It's crazy to me.
Yeah, I had to look it up when I was reading the story, and I was just like, wait, when did this book end? 7 years ago. And it literally, literally picks up right where it left off. At the end of that run, Loki walks through a door and it's just like, all right, see you next time. And then in this story, he literally is walking through that same door, but we get to see what's on the opposite side. And he's like, oh, hey, guys, long time no see.
Just by the same creative team of writer Al Ewing, artist Lee Garbett. In this issue, it's colored by Antonio Fabella and lettered by VC Joe Sabino. So really neat. Yeah. Another great thing, which, you know, I'm always here for, is a Jason Aaron Thor family story. So we have an Odin story featuring Jason Aaron writing it with art by Das Pastoris and lettered by VC's Joe Sabino. Das did some great art in Thor, God of Thunder. So we get a whole bunch of these great stories by the creators, and then it comes back around to the core story by Donnie and Nick and crew that sets Odin off into the ether, but really tells you what's going on. The thing that I particularly loved here is the reasoning for what's going on, and that we get a sense of why Odin is the way he is at the end of this story, which is vague enough where you still need to read it to learn about it. But I was like, oh, that's exciting and terrifying. Yeah. I can't wait to see where this goes. It is exactly what you want out of a friggin' comic book, to get you right at the end with a gut punch and like a hook to say, all right, here we go. Get in the car. And like, yes, we're going to drive off.
And not only that, but honor what's come before. I love this book so much.
Hell yeah. All right. We are going to get into the rest of the books for this week, but it is time for some awards talk. Jasmine, what was the award from last week?
So last week's award name was the Living Loaves of Cultured Hamburger, which was found in the Avengers number 55.
That was a good one. It was a great quote, but also easy to find if you read alphabetically or maybe you read your favorite titles, because Avengers is a damn fine title. And pretty shortly after the episode released, we had a flurry of folks getting the award correct. First was, though, Karis Pollard at A. Woo. Karis Pollard. Woo! Thank you, Karis, coming in there. Yes, she does have an advantage because she's...
I thought that was funny.
Several hours ahead being in the UK. But got to give it up to our pal Steve Agnew at Viking Prince, who got it, and Space Tardigrade at Lex Pendragon, who were also in there, like, really close. So everybody's a winner with this.
I also love that everyone's just like, like giving each other a pat on the back for finding it. Like, it's just like, everyone's nice.
Totally.
I love our community. Are you ready for this week's award, Ryan?
I am.
All right. This week, we are giving away the Nice Multiverse You Have Here award.
Yes. And if you find this quote, screen cap it and tweet it to at Agent M and at Jasmiest with hashtag Marvel's pull list, or email us at pulllist@marvel.com. If you're the first, maybe you get something fun. I mean, you will. Our listeners are incredible and it takes a lot of work to find these at times. So thank you all for participating.
Yeah.
All right. Let's roll on into the new books this week. First up, we have Alien number 11. I am right off the top giving my Nice Multiverse You Have Here award to cover artist Mark Aspinall. The main cover on this book is one of the most stunning pieces of xenomorph art. It got these blues and oranges on it that is just unlike anything you ever see when it comes to a lot of the alien stories. And that carries over into the book as we're following this, the xenomorphs as they're running rampant on this planet and finally getting in here into a lot of the behind the scenes and the really just sinister freaking stuff that is behind all of this. This issue in particular ramped up everything for me in this arc.
All right. Next up, we have Carnage number 2. And I right off the bat too want to give my award to the artist of this book, Francesco Manna. Because there is this double page spread in this book that is so just like visceral that when you see it, it not only frames all these different moments within Carnage's like history and like what they've been through, but also the character that is the center of this page. You get to see what got them to this point in their life, but the way that the character is like, it's like almost out of focus, but also like being like shaken around. It's just very disturbing. And so when you see it, you can feel this like anxiety about it that is very much in line with what the story is about. So I want to give them my Nice Multiverse You Have Here award.
All right, let's roll on into Hulk Grand Design Madness, the second of the two Hulk Grand Design issues that is all done by Jim Rugg, and it's a whopper. I want to give my nice multiverse you have here award to a two-page sequence, right? There's one page where you're following Hulk as he's in a story where he's been attacked and then teamed up with X-Factor. This is like the late 80s, mid-late 80s, and then you turn the page, and it is one of the most like bombastic, stark, exciting page turns I've gotten. And it's simply going from the one page to the next is a cover recreation of Incredible Hulk number 340, but also some extra bits of Hulk fighting Man-Bull and the Leader and some other stuff. And it is so bright and so exciting and so cool. I stared at this page for a good couple of minutes being like, damn, Jim, this is some good ass stuff.
It's so gorgeous. This book is great. And there will be a reading list on MU with all of those books in order of
very
appearance.
Smart.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Very excited about it. All right, next up we have Ms. Marvel Beyond the Limit number 5, which is the last issue of this Beyond the Limit miniseries. And I want to give my nice multiverse you have here award to Samira Ahmed. We kind of talked to her about it when we were talking about Ms. Marvel in one of our reading clubs a couple of episodes back. But just the use of downtime, where it's not like we have to go and like, you know, punch and go. It's very much like, okay, let's take a break, let's regroup. And while we're, you know, eating food to essentially get energy to fight back and like go back, like it's Nadia, Ms. Marvel, and Bruno just in the back.
We don't talk about
I know them. That's why I forgot it, obviously, duh. They're in the back of Circle Q just kind of like hanging out as they're trying to figure out what their plan is to finish, you know, Korn off, to figure out how to like not only just defeat her but send her back to her universe and like make sure that everything's okay, because the last thing they want to do is, you know, ruin her life any further. And I like that they are problem solving while also like, you know, just hanging out. I like the use of downtime in this book a lot. And I know that Samira is very aware of it. And I like that narrative device.
Yeah. On to Punisher number 2, which another one was very nearly one of my picks of the week because it's so friggin' good. Holy cannoli, this one it's epic. Jason Aaron is a madman and telling this Frank Castle story. He's just not holding back. And thankfully, he's got amazing collaborators. I want to shout out Jesus Saiz in here. Of course, Paul Azaceta, but my nice multiverse you have here award I'm giving to the team in all over for a single page spread that they have about halfway into the issue. Punisher is displeased with someone. You have this conversation that is escalating. And then Frank Castle has shurikens in between his knuckles, in his hands, cutting himself bloody, but he's hurting someone with his fist and these things. And he screams, "The only war I give a damn about is mine." And it's just this big moment. And I was just like, gonna do some push-ups. I'm gonna
hell
like,
yeah. No, the adrenaline was pumping. The minute you start using shurikens as brass knuckles, like all bets are off. Like, oh my god. And then can we just hint at that last page reveal? Because that pumped me up. Next up we have Sabretooth number 3. And I have a tie for this one. Because I want to give my nice multiverse you have here award to one Victor Laval for just being able to make Xavier terrifyingly creepy and scary. Like I'm like legit scared of Xavier. And there's this whole story that goes on throughout this issue where Melter is very much afraid of Professor X. And it's not necessarily for any bad reasons. It's just like his omnipresence is the thing that he's afraid of. And the way that the story is told, he is like a boogeyman in this. And I find that very interesting. But I also want to give credit to the artist on this book, and that's Leonard Kirk, because he does draw Professor X in such a creepy way, and the angles that he uses are really fascinating and very much like from horror movies. The people who are in the pit, the mutants that are in the pit, find a way to essentially break out, which I think is really interesting, and it's not quite what you would expect. And the way that these characters are drawn outside of the pit is just so awesome. He is clearly just flexing a muscle that he hasn't been able to flex in a while, and he's just showing off at this point. But also, we get some bling action in this book, so I'm very excited.
All right, on to Silk number 4. There's a lot of great moments. Emily Kim, so good.
So good.
Silk. Her dialogue is fantastic. There are a bunch of conversations that happen in here with Silk supporting characters, which nearly got my award. But my nice multiverse you have here award, I am giving to Silk's mask, her disguise, because she's going through some stuff. And so she puts on a mask to sort of like get around while still not revealing what's going on with her. And her mask is, it's fantastic. I laughed out loud. It was great.
It's perfect for the situation and who she's talking to, too. Next up is Silver Surfer Rebirth number 4. And I'm sorry, I gotta give, hey, nice multiverse you have here award to Ron Lim, because so we get 4 versions of the Silver Surfer from different eras of Silver Surfer's history. They're each drawn in a very distinct way from different eras, from different artist styles throughout the years. We have, you know, a version of Silver Surfer that looks like the one that Jack Kirby drew, one that John Buscema drew. Speaking of Mobius, Mobius's Silver Surfer is in here, as well as Michael Allred's from Dan Slott's run on Silver Surfer. And it's weird to me that you can like make the Silver Surfer look distinctly different across 4 different versions of him, but like they do it, and the way that they accomplish it in this book is really fascinating, especially with textures and colors. But I mean, how many ways can you draw Silver Surfer and make them look different? Apparently 5.
All right, last book of the week is Star Wars Crimson Reign number 4. I'm going to give my nice multiverse you have here award to the arrival of the Knights of Ren deep into this story. I don't want to spoil where they go and who they interact with, but there's a whole sequence towards the end. I was like, oh, damn, this is happening.
Yeah. So that's all we have for Fresh Floppies this week. On the MU side, we have a bunch of Infinity Comics coming to the app, including X-Men Unlimited, Infinity Comic number 32, Spider-Verse Unlimited, Infinity Comic number 4, White Fox Infinity Comic number 4, and Marvel Meow Infinity Comic number 5.
And big shout out to last week. We had some surprise drops for the Who Is Infinity Comics. Those are super cool. One of them is written by one of my closest friends in this life or any other, Alex Segura, who I literally saw him like a week ago. He didn't tell me he was doing this book. He did the America Chavez one. Anyway, go read his stuff on MU. Like, you can also read a whole bunch of other books. There's some Devil Rain stuff on Marvel Unlimited. A new issue of Moon Knight is hitting. Most importantly, I think maybe for this week on MU, first issues of both Silk and She-Hulk hit Marvel Unlimited this week.
Get also Silver Surfer Rebirth, if you're feeling a little cosmic.
Oh, yeah. I missed that one. Yeah, for sure. Those are great. Those are really great books. A lot to check out this week on Marvel Unlimited.
Yeah, and over on the collection side of things, we have Phoenix Song Echo, Spider-Gwen Deal with the Devil, and the X-Men Omnibus by Jonathan Hickman. That's a gorgeous hardcover omnibus that I might have to get and bring my bag for. So, yeah.
All right, you know what deserves all the omnibuses in the world? X-Men Executioner Song, baby!
How did I know you were going to say that?
Because that is time for our reading club part 2 with Tochi Onyebuchi. We're going to get into it. We're going to talk about some Captain America stuff that he's working on. I am going to stop yapping now and let us hear from Tochi.
Yeah.
The story that we're talking about is X-Men Executioner Song. We go into the next part, which is part 3, X-Men number 14, which is actually Andy Kubert's first issue on X-Men, which I didn't realize. It says it very clearly there, but I was looking before him and, you know, Jim Lee had finished with 12 and there were a couple of fill-ins. But then, yeah, Andy comes in. He has a good long tenure doing X-Men stuff. But love
the trigger happy Bishop. Like, he's just like,
he's front and center. You could feel him tapping his foot. Like, I gotta do something. But we get Sinister and we get members of the MLF. And I love the fashion choices for Jungle Safari, Forearm and Reaper. Yeah, Reaper. Mm-hmm. For Forearm and Reaper here, it's just they got their shorty shorts on, yeah. their vests. Ugh, it's tremendous.
It really is. It really, really, really is. And even like on a smaller level, I think it's page 60, that last panel of Sinister holding the canister, you know, that allegedly contains like the genetic matrix of, I believe, the Summers family. That last panel, it looks like he's licking the canister.
It's so gross.
Yeah.
But feels very in character.
Very in character.
We don't depict smoking in our comics now, which I appreciate. But at the same time, there's this shot of Wolverine, this full, like half page, but like vertical shot of Wolverine talking and he's lighting up a cigarette. And I'm like, man, he looks so badass.
It's such a like intro, like a dramatic introduction to a character, like in a scene, yep, where he's just like, all these characters are having like discussions on like what's going on. And he's just like leaning up against the wall. And you can just hear the like flicker of the,
yep,
of his like Zippo, just like,
yep, yep.
What are you guys talking about? Like, he says, yeah, maybe it's just the way of the world that did it. Maybe the dream is dead. Just being super dramatic. Right. Like,
maybe we should all stop pretending it ain't and accept the fact we're living in a nightmare.
Meanwhile, yeah, everybody else on X Factor is just like wafting away the smoke. Like, dude, chill. Like, yeah, yeah, I get it. You like
Straw like, Guy's like,
like, cool, man. We get it.
You're so gross, little dude.
Like, who let you in?
Yeah.
Where'd you come from?
Dude, you totally can't smoke in here.
Let's move on to the next issue, because this is where we, yeah, start seeing these like big showdowns. Yes.
The teaser for issue 4 at the end of part 3 is X versus X, Bishop versus Sinister, Cyclops and Jean discover a startling secret.
Yep, yep, yep.
And this is the issue where we get that beast,
yeah,
that you were,
yeah,
talking about too. So it's like, it's fully detailed. Like his belt is like barely hanging on to him. Ugh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, also on the note of the drawing of really gross things, like in this same issue in part 4, Sinister gets shot, mm-hmm, in the head.
Yes, it's, and so it's gross.
It's so gross, and it's like, it, you know what it brought to mind, because I'm pretty sure this came out, you know, around the same time, where they're melded together in my head. But Terminator 2 Judgment Day.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. I was just when about to say that.
Yeah,
and there's like no blood or anything either. It's just like a hole in his head, and you're just like, this is still disgusting. And like,
yes,
okay, but we also get that amazing shot of Cable with like, yes,
it's
where he's just wearing a tank. Like,
I should have this as a tattoo, like on my heart.
Like, there's no skin in this picture, it's just metal and bags.
Yes,
yeah, we get a beautiful Strife page after that, but then the sort of Wolverine and the X teams tracking down the X Force kids. And I've always thought about how Wolverine, you know, jumps out of the shadows, jumps out of the bushes, takes down Cannonball and leaps away so fast where Feral can't get to him. And like, they're just like hunting them. And
yeah,
it is, they are so outclassed.
Yep.
It is wild. This panel of multiple man,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Straight fire.
But also that panel on the same page of Wolverine catching Feral, and all you see is, you see Feral, and then you see Wolverine's like fist with two claws out on either side of Feral's neck. And you know, if that middle claw comes out, it's curtains. It's curtains. But it's so gangster.
And it's like, my favorite part is that there's two snakes sound effects,
yes,
like letters there. So it's not like he did them at simultaneously. It was like he did, mm-hmm, one and then two. And then, ooh, he was just like, third one's, you know, right here.
Yeah, he didn't want to kill her. So he was just being extra careful at that point. All right, next part is another Uncanny X-Men issue. We got gross, gnarly Apocalypse, like just trying to climb back out of his thing and feeling all gross. My favorite part, right away in this issue, is Jubilee yelling at all the X-Force kids. She's like, you know, a couple years younger than them.
Yep.
And just calling them loser, poorly dressed, overly accessorized, delusionally disadvantaged X-Men wannabes.
She calls them hyperthyroided.
Yes, I saw that too. And I was like, wow, she's just going straight for the jugular. Like, literally.
Yeah, she's roasting them. Yeah.
And then she, and then like, then Strong Guy tries to stop her, and he's like, all right, chill, you got to stop. And then she was like, let me go, you third generation Colossus knockoff. Like, that is amazing.
Psylocke comes in at one point. She almost kills Professor Xavier. She thinks about it, like, to put him out of his misery, in a sense. Just so dramatic. Yeah. It's so dramatic. And that is one page.
It was a story on its own.
I was about to make that very same point. Like, you literally have an entire arc's worth of material, like, in that one. If she had gone through on that, that, like, would have had consequences for the entire Marvel universe. And it's just, like, one page.
That, those are my favorites. Like, when artists can, like, just fill one page with, like, a complete story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What I like is that there's, like, a mentor-mentee dynamic. And so, like, Wolverine is very old. It goes back again. Bishop is young. Like, he looks older than he is. But, you know, Wolverine's like, Wolverine calls everybody kid. But, like, he does see him as like, hey, let's do this together. And he even says, you kind of remind me of me in my youth, which is, it's a really sweet moment there.
Yeah. At the end of this chapter, too, we get some of Ryan's favorite character, Gambit.
Mm.
Just, you know, coming in, getting a little action. No, it's him and Havoc interrogating Cannonball, which is like, again, talk about trigger happy, like, character. Like, Gambit needs to chill. Like,
yeah.
Havoc's like, I'm just trying to figure out what's happening. And Gambit's like, but what if I throw this card at you?
In the, we're all in the same room. Like, you know what happens if that card goes off.
By the end of the issue, we get Wolverine and Bishop. They've found Cable. And it has another one of those really funny moments. Like, they crash through the wall and Cable is getting there at the same time. And he just quietly goes to himself, it's going to be one of those days.
Yes.
We jump to part six, which is another X-Factor issue, and has one of the coolest opening pages and panels. Wolverine and Bishop there. Like, again, Jay Lee drawing the gnarliest muscles on Bishop. It is.
And then you go to the next, you flip the page and you see that big spread. And it's like, talk about gnarly muscles. Like,
oh my goodness. Yeah.
It's literally a shot of Cable and, you know, Bishop going at each other. Story. I love the name of the story, too. It's called Snicks and Bones.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes.
This also has the MLF, the Mutant Liberation Front, fight against the combined X-Men, X-Factor, and a little bit of X-Force team here. It is so mean. It's just like, they just beat the tar out of the MLF. Like, there's one point where you see Dragoness, like, she gets just destroyed by Rogue, Polaris, and Storm. You get Tempo.
I was going to say Tempo in there, just getting beat up. And I'm like, oh, poor Tempo.
I know. And then you got one of the coolest panels, which always, like, it's sort of like an optical illusion, the way Forearm holds Archangel and, like, who's arm is where and whose face. It's so cool, so amazingly done. And then you have poor stupid Kamikaze coming in from behind. And that moment where Archangel just turns and his razor sharp wings cut off Kamikaze's head. You get a decapitation in this issue, a bouncing head.
Yep.
It is boing boing boing, and then Boom Boom throws up all over.
Yep.
So funny because she's like, because, like, it bounces right next to her, and she's like, what is... Oh, no! Yeah.
And she says, it touched me! Oh! It's like, yeah, the MLF does get pretty trashed, but Wildside and Reaper do take down Quicksilver and Gambit. Mm-hmm. So, respect.
Yeah. I think that was one of the things that I was always really excited about, you know, with these types of arcs, was that there's literally action and fighting on, like, every single page of this issue, and yet it all moves the story forward. And, like, this is the issue where, you know, we get Cable basically saying, hey, look, it wasn't me. And so we're like, okay, what's going on? Because we clearly saw you were the one who did it. They have no reason to suspect that he has a clone.
In part seven, we get a lot of aftermath. There's still a lot of fun fighting and running and stuff. There's a great moment. We talked about the coffee moments, but Strong Guy gives coffee to Colossus, who, it's great, but Colossus, one panel, you get this incredible pathos and sadness from Colossus because he's just dealt with the loss of his brother and this whole thing, which if you're reading X-Men comics now, you know that like Mikhail Rasputin is this big major character going on in those storylines. But Strong Guy says, a fine blend if I say so myself, talking about the coffee, Hawaiian hazelnut mocha cream Jack Daniels. And it's just, he's got the little cup with his fingers.
No, my favorite is like, so he says all of that. And then Colossus is like, do you have good news to tell me? And then Strong Guy's like, yep, I put too much JD in there.
Just.
And I'm like, wow.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
Wow. Bravo.
Yes.
This is the issue in which Strife force feeds baby food to Cyclops.
It's so like, it makes me like, I have like a visceral reaction when I see it. I'm just like, ew, gross.
It's Andy Kubert art. It's again, it's going, he does really, really great, like gross texture, liquid feeling things on face.
And Strife is like, there's a good boy.
Yeah, as he's shoving it into his mouth. And then he's like, afterwards, he's like, little boy, enjoy his dinner. Did I do it right?
Like, yo, the psychosis.
Is that how you nurse a child?
We get Strife rolling up to Apocalypse's house and being like, fight me. He just comes in. He's like, fight me, old man. And you get the Dark Riders, who's such cool character designs. Like, they're just these gnarly, weird 90s mutants. And he lays them out right away. You get Strife
all of
yelling,
you useless, unfit.
Yeah.
Unfit.
And then he like meets Apocalypse at the end of this issue, and he's just like, Apocalypse. And Apocalypse is just like, who are you? I'm sorry. Like, should I know you?
Yeah. But, and then, I mean, just tremendous. As you are the devil of yesterday who haunts my tomorrows, I am the demon of tomorrow who has come for cold retribution. I am Strife. Remember it, for that is the name of the man who is going to kill you. Whew. Best comic book ever.
I mean, if you're going to do that, if you're going to say all of that to Apocalypse, like, you better come in swinging.
Yeah.
You better hope.
Yeah.
You better be locked and loaded, ready to go.
Meanwhile, Apocalypse is thinking, it's going to be one of those days.
One of the rad things is when we get into X-Force, the next issue, another issue drawn by Greg Capullo, you get this beautiful splash page to open it up with Strife and Apocalypse. And then you flip over and they flip the art on its side.
Yeah.
And it just, you know what? This is how we're doing it. And you get awesome, awesome action changes, the flow of it, and you go back and forth on that. It's rad as hell.
Yeah.
In the battle, Strife stabs Apocalypse with a blade that has Apocalypse's face on it.
Just like, yo.
Even Apocalypse is just like, what the heck? Yeah. Like, he's like, the blade, but how? When I once used it to kill you.
Yeah.
Like, he's just like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
Apocalypse was able to teleport himself out, and we get one of my favorite 90s phrases in the X-Men comics spoken by Cable and Strife: stab his eyes. Yep. I will still say that. It's like, you know, there are certain folks, I think the wrestler MVP will call people flat scans, which is like a derogatory term for humans. If you're like a bad mutant, like, look at those flat scans.
Look at those flat scans.
It's like muggles.
Yeah.
In Harry Potter.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like, this is also, if I remember correctly, just sort of tracing the dramatic arc of the overall story, this, I think, is the first time that we see Strife's face.
Mm-hmm.
He takes it off to fight Apocalypse.
Yep. And then we're like, wait, does Cable have a clone? Like, is this a split personality? Like, what's going on?
Part 9.
Yeah.
I love that this book opens with that like splash page of like Scott holding Jean that is very like reminiscent of like the Phoenix Saga, and you're like, "Oh, what's going on?" Like, cuz like last time we saw them was in that panel where they were trying to escape in the last issue, mm-hmm. like right after we saw Strife watching them.
Mm-hmm.
What just happened between these two issues? And it's like immediately you get the answers as you continue flipping the book, which I really liked.
Mm-hmm.
But it ends up being like not real.
And also too, can we take a moment to appreciate this cover and the mystery in this cover? We have Strife sort of lording over Cyclops, who's ready to blasts something off page, but he's also holding a baby.
Yep.
In one hand.
Who's the baby? What's going on?
Yeah.
Even the baby's like, what am I doing? Yeah. What is this? Yeah. Like, he looks so surprised. Yeah. Like, oh.
He's like, yeah. I am obviously lost.
It's very much one of those, like, you're probably wondering why I, like freeze frame. Like, yeah, like, you're probably wondering how I got here.
Yeah. So Cyclops and Jean Grey have to escape. The Dark Riders are here and all this other stuff. But there's the way they escape is Jean uses her telekinesis. And, like, it's visualized as this almost, like, grappling hook. I've always mm-hmm. thought about that. It's like, you don't see that enough. The way she mm-hmm. does that and she swings them, and it's like in Star Wars, like in A New Hope, when Leia and Luke, you know, swing off across the chasm. It's almost got that feeling.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. And it also feels like Spider-Man, like Amazing Fantasy 15, where he's just carrying the person with him.
Yeah. She's carrying him because, I mean, yes, Jean exactly. always carries Scott.
Always.
Obviously.
Like, the captions on that page read, and in that final panel, as opposed to Cyclops, Jean Grey has always embraced her mutant abilities. Blessed with the natural talents of telepathy and telekinetics, she felt she couldn't be happier with her genetic gifts. That was before Scott Summers, before she'd sacrificed her life on his behalf, only to learn there are greater powers than death in the universe, and the greatest of these is love. So there's a lot of really complicated stuff going on with regards to her self-conceptualization and being with Scott.
Which leads us to part 10, which has one of my favorite covers of the whole run, because you've got Archangel with this horrifying grin on his face, and he's in darkness, and Apocalypse is laughing, and the techno-organic virus is taking over Xavier. It is so scary. It was so like what I was talking about earlier, when we were going to the shop and picking up these issues and you couldn't read it right there, all you saw was the cover. Yep. It was like,
ooh, yeah.
Yep. Ah, I got to get home. I got to go home. I got to read this. I got to know what happens.
Yep.
Just, I think this is my favorite issue too, because the art in this is like the one that immediately, like, it just sticks out to me, like, because it's Jay Lee's art. Mm-hmm. It's colored by Glennis Oliver, but like the colors are very like matte and flat. Mm-hmm. Like, there's not a whole lot of like variation. It's like, I don't know how to explain it. It's very colorful and very vivid. I like how smooth it all looks.
Yeah, like a prime example is that two-page spread after the first page where you see all these characters. It's exactly what you're describing. Yeah.
I do want to go to the page. Yes. It's 224 on our in our collection.
Where I was.
This is my favorite page in this entire book.
Silent.
Silent, and it's like, it's very like evocative of where they're at. They're in space. No sound is there. You get no lettering. It's very clear, like, the communication is just done by, like, the facial acting. Mm-hmm. And the thing that, like, blows me away is that, like, Scott is completely in the shadows, and the only thing you see is his visor, and he's still able to, like, express, like, emotion as he's looking down towards Jean and picks her up. And I'm just like, I love it. Like, I love every bit of this. Like, give me an entire issue like this. It's perfect.
Yeah.
It's the amazing pacing of those quiet moments, to Apocalypse starting to do the process to remove the techno-organic virus from Xavier, to Strife, you know, yelling at Cyclops and Jean. And it's, you know, it just, over the course of like six pages, you get tons of character work and tense moments, beautiful art.
I was gonna say,
art.
The tension. Ugh. The tension across this issue is just like being built up to like a boiling
like
point,
even
really.
Even going back to that Apocalypse moment where he's working on Xavier, it's not clear like what he's doing,
right?
You know, and Beast is like, I think this is page 234, he's expunging the virus. And then you, in that panel, you see Beast being blocked by Archangel's wings, and everybody's like, wait a second, what's going on? And then at the end, they're like, havoc we've been had, Archangel's been taken over by Apocalypse again, he's out to destroy Xavier once and for all. And then you see that silent shot of Archangel's face, and he's just looking at what's going on, he's blocking everybody else, and you're like, what is going on in his head right now?
But you do, after all that, get that, like, the poltergeist moment, the house is clean. It was like, the operation is over. And he stomps on this little, you know, this little robot.
Like scorpion type thing. Yeah.
It looks like the bug that they put in
Neo.
In the Matrix. In Neo. When they suck it out. And then it also at the same time, like, the operating system is done uploading. Cable has finished whittling his little domino doll out of that slab of wood that he somehow
got. Which is
got.
Really sweet. Which is, like, really, yeah. really, really sweet. Like, that's yeah. another one of those really Ugh. Small but really, like, lovely character touches.
Yep.
And as totally Easter egg. And as somebody who, my very first Marvel thing that I wrote was actually a one-shot about Domino.
Really?
Yeah. And so this.
Say more about that.
Yeah. So I got, I had the incredible opportunity to write a one shot for Marvel's Voices Legacy, the issue that came out, I want to say February of 2021. And they let me choose whoever I wanted to choose, basically. And I chose Domino. And I wrote this. One of my favorite short stories ever about her, you know, busting in on a card game and shenanigans ensuing. But there's a panel there where she's talking about the effect of her powers of, you know, the manipulation of luck and probability on people around her, and how oftentimes it has seemed that because she basically sucks up all the good luck in a room, everybody around her has bad luck. And there's one point where she's like, makes it hard to keep a boyfriend. And it's that, panel is like a flashback to that moment in, I want to say, Messiah Complex, where Cable is holding up the portal so that I think it's members of Uncanny X-Force can like come through. It's part of the mission to rescue Hope. And the only way that he's able to keep the portal open is by letting the techno-organic virus consume him, and it closes shut and he dies. And like,
I love that story.
Yo, it's Domino has to watch that happen. So that's, you know, bringing it all full circle to see Cable in this quiet moment in like 1993, whittling, you know, a block of wood into a Domino figurine. It just, chef's kiss.
How creepy would it be though, like later, if like Domino's just like over and she's like, why did you do this? You, like, yeah. When did you do this? Yeah, and like, why?
When did you do this?
This issue ends and just so perfect. And you get that moment of Wolverine like, we've hit a snag, when they see that they're up against just tons of enemies as they're closing in on Strife's forces. And then you open up the next issue and it's just this big hero threesome. Yeah. Of Cable, Bishop, and Wolverine, claws and guns and pouches and everything. And I, one of the things I really dig about this fight is the feeling of scale. It feels like they're in a big location. Yeah. You know, you get that sense. You've got characters from up on high and things happening all around them. I think that's really well placed within the scene.
Mm-hmm. But also like movement, like as like the fight continues, you can like feel them moving through wherever they're at. Like, they're like making their way through all of this. It's not like they're just in a room and all these people are popping out of nowhere.
Yeah. Like, and it's like
flooding in.
Like page 246, that first panel, the way that verticality is used with Wolverine, just like balletic, it's beautiful to look at.
It is.
The X-Men arrive. You get this big throwdown. It's all kinds of cool stuff. I love Strife. He's got this teleporter named Zero, who's got a big zero on his face, and Zero doesn't talk. He's almost like Strife's silent therapist, and Strife just gets to like pour his heart out to him. And he's got this great, you know, bit where he's like, such a complicated tapestry we have woven. Time is but a puzzle, and we place the pieces where we see fit, as awkwardly, I imagine, as the analogies I spout.
he's very self-aware. Yeah, very, you know, he just self-aware.
Knows.
Yeah. The final chapter is in X-Force, which just like lets Greg Capullo just go ham. And you got that beautiful first page Cable just like, Strife, time's up. Yep. And then you flip it again. I know you don't like it, Jazz, because you don't like changing your orientation, but man, you got to remember, these were initially, you know, single issues. So
yeah, I understand.
Flows a little bit better than, you know, when you're trade, if you don't want to bend the spine at all, but bend that spine, let it breathe.
It's like getting creases on my spine on like books, and then getting creases on my sneakers that are like, those are my two pet peeves. Mm-hmm. And it's just like,
mm-hmm. It just hurts in your heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like, okay.
We get another stab your eyes in this battle. Cable going up against Strife, and you get just this big dramatic, there's wild machine thing on the moon.
What a devastating battle. Oh, away from me, Half-Life. Like, it's one of those things where, you know, just like as somebody who like watches a ton of anime, where you can trace the like physical deterioration of characters over the course of a battle as they get more and more desperate. Like that page 276 where Cable slices Stripe's chest open and then comes to his feet and his clothes are basically all torn off except for his boots. And you see the like half metal of him.
I love that you brought the anime like idea into it, because the story is called Ghost in the Machine, and I immediately thought of Ghost in the Shell.
Yep.
And so like we have the first manga, like serialized manga, mm-hmm. coming out around that time. The anime like feature film comes out in 95. So it's like very much like in the zeitgeist.
Yeah. This is my storytelling diet. Like all of this. Executioner's Song, Ghost in the Shell,
Akira. As you can tell by like the stuff in your back background shelves.
Exactly. Like this is why I am the storyteller I am today. So what's interesting, so talking about the, you know, like the pacing and the juxtaposition of storylines, while Cable and Strife are duking it out, there's this really emotional sequence happening between Apocalypse and Archangel. On 278, you know, Apocalypse is like on the verge of death. And Archangel's just like standing over him. And they have this whole thing, like, my angel of death, you are as I made you, strong, a killer, a survivor. And then Archangel says, maybe, but long before I met you, I am a man. And if you go back to earlier in this issue, when Cable first confronts Strife, page 270, that stab your eyes panel, stab your eyes, I'm a man, I'm my own man. Yo, like, what?
It's like some poetic, like, just like parallel.
It's so good. It's so mm-hmm. good.
The just straight disrespect of, and he's saying, like, as everyone's fighting around me to just die here slowly, mm-hmm. feebled, it is not the way to go.
And you're right, it is a C story, because at the same time, we're also getting the B side of the story, which is back on Earth with Beast and Jubilee, mm-hmm. and like, with the professor's recovery, and like him kind of putting all the like connecting all the dots here.
And then the big story, the big culmination is Strife just fighting everyone. It's like,
yeah,
Cable and Cyclops and Jean and Havoc, and just they're blasting each other. And at his core, he's just so sad, and he just feels betrayed and cast aside, and he's so upset, and I want to believe you, I do, but how can I? Why am I suffering this way? I'm not the guilty one. You are. You all are. Blah. And then that great panel where I leave you what you left me, a legacy of hatred, a legacy of decay, a loss of hope, a loss of life, a pox on all mutant kind.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, and like, and you're supposed to think, oh, that's just him in the moment. That's just him being upset, him being angry, him being verbose. There's nothing intentional about that language.
Of course not.
Huh.
Yeah.
Thinking emoji. No, but I think, you know, going back to the point about Strife at his core being just like a sad child, like that page before, you know, he says, I want to believe you. I think it's 281. You know, Jean at one point is like, we can work to heal your wounds, whatever they are, let's work them out together. And then Strife has this moment where it's the lettering in the word bubble is so small. You can hear it as like almost a whisper or a whimper in his voice. He's like, together? All of us together? And then he's like, no, you're lying. If I trust you, you'll just betray me again. And it's like, he's just a kid. He's just...
Yeah, he's struggling too, because like the next page, he's like, I want to believe you. I don't know how I can.
Yeah.
Like, after this ultimate betrayal.
That final page that we teased about a little bit, it says, as the old song dies, a new chorus begins, because it's Sinister coming back after, you know, it's seven mm-hmm. issues or so, fulfilling, like picking up that last plot thread. And he opens up the canister he had been licking, and his dude opens the canister and he's like, it's empty. And then he's like, oh,
God. He's so mad.
Why should I be surprised?
Again? Yeah. Fooled again.
Yeah. But then the guy right there is just like hacking up a lung immediately. Mm-hmm. And he says, please do look after that cough. And that right there, tied with the legacy stuff that Strife says, is the sort of the subtle early kickoff to the legacy virus, which would ravage the mutant populace for a good couple of years.
Yeah.
I did not know that this is where it came from. And when I saw that last panel, I was just like, wait. And it was like a total like, oh my God, I could not believe that they like snuck that in here.
Yeah.
It's one of the random like plot threads in this thing. You don't really care about it until like that last page. And like, they put this here for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at it in hindsight, like after like, you know, years of the fact that all these stories have been published. And I'm just like, that's wild. Like, they planted the seed so early and like in such a big event too. Like, it's like, we're not done yet.
I love, love, love stuff. Because it's so small. It's so small. It's so small. And it ends up leading to like one of the biggest events in like X history, like the one of the biggest. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me a lot of when Legion went back in time to try to kill Magneto, because he reasoned that if Magneto was not around, Charles would have had more time and energy to spend with him and raise his son. And so he goes back in time. And at this point in the relationship between Charles and you know, Eric, they're friends. They've just met. I think they're in Israel at the time. And I think Xavier's like recovering from some wound. They become friends. They talk politics and all this stuff. And so Legion goes back in time, tries to kill Magneto, but Xavier jumps in the way and he ends up killing Xavier instead. And that gives us Age of Apocalypse.
Yeah. Legion Quest storyline. Real good. If you have the trade, like we've been talking about with the mm-hmm. collected edition, it includes the epilogue issue of Uncanny X-Men 297, which is great. It's six characters. Archangel and Beast going to repair their
Harry's Hideaway.
Yeah, the Harry's Hideaway, their haunt that the X-Men have, you know, gone to for decades, because it got trashed at the first issue of the storyline. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
You get Rogue and Gambit having some heart-to-heart moments because
just having all the moody.
Yep.
Yeah.
Moody angst.
Well, she's like, aired so, out. So I have a question actually. At this point, do we have in the X stories? Do we have an out and out Gambit Rogue romance, or is this the seed planted for that?
I think they've had a little bit of, they've had some dalliances because he's a creep. And so he's been creeping on her like a creep.
Yeah.
He's a total creep in this, story too. I mean, just like looks wise. Like, I'm just like,
oh yeah. The hair. Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Like if this guy was on the subway.
Oh no, forget
I'd be like, I'm going to go to the next.
Yeah. Car. I'm moving cars. Yeah.
Yeah.
But my favorite part is the Professor Xavier and Jubilee stuff, because at this point, Xavier had been in his wheelchair for so long and he's standing up and he's walking around and he has this conversation with Jubilee and it's quiet. It is just them. This issue always evokes to me feelings of the fall and just with the leaves rustling through a lot of these pages. Like, I can feel an autumn breeze when I read this issue, and it's sweet and it's super sad. And
that ending is a gut punch.
Yeah.
There's another epilogue, but I don't remember ever reading it. It's the X-Force issue. That's another epilogue to this. But there's in this collection is Strife Strike File, which is just the handbook in Strife's words of who all the major players of the storyline were.
There's three pages of villains that hadn't even been introduced yet in the main stories.
Oh, yeah. Fabian Cortez and Gideon. I love Gideon.
Yep.
Like, some of the characters that appeared like a year later after, like, their first appearance was in the Strike Files.
I forgot
about
that.
Yeah.
In the Strike Files also ties into the trading cards, because the trading cards were branded as Strike Files.
Yep.
And they had beautiful art on them, and some of the sort of like Strife POV around these various characters. You've got interior art in some original places by Larry Stroman, who does not get enough love. Who is just friggin' tremendous in and of himself. His X-Factor stuff was bonkers cool.
Mm.
Tochi, this was a fun adventure. I'm glad we did this.
Oh, same.
This was so great.
Big thanks again to Tochi Onyebuchi for coming on the show, for sharing the love for the greatest comic book story of all time, X-Men Executioner Song.
Greatest of all time?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. 100%. Without question.
According to who?
Everyone. Everyone, it's in the Guinness Book of World Records. Don't question it. It is what it is. It's true. And that is a wrap for us. This episode of Marvel's Pull List was produced by Ryan Panagos, Jasmine Estrada, and Cara McGurk-Allison.
Jill Duboff is our director of audio.
And Brad Barton is Marvel's Pull List Senior Manager of Audio Production and Development. We were talking about X-Men Executioner Song and how the original series, each issue came polybagged and had a trading card and everything. I know that Brad worked really hard to try to get as many copies of those as possible back in the day to try to like make it work. You know, he wanted to tip the market in his favor and and actually build a little nest egg for himself with copies of X-Men Executioner Song. And
did it work? Oh, that's a bummer. Sorry, Brad. Yeah,
he spent a lot of money.
Are they? Does he still have them? Do you think?
Yeah, he sleeps on them.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense because he doesn't have a house.
Yeah, no, he's just he's got a nice bed of the greatest comic book story of all time, which in and of itself is a reward.
Yeah, it could be worse.
Yeah. I'm Ryan.
I'm Jasmine.
This is Marvel.
Your universe.